Like, you actually need enough stability in your life to allow yourself to change. Whether it's a partner, it's your family of origin, it's like some community or religion or something that you're a part of, you do need to feel safe in order to take a risk. And so finally I had that check mark fulfilled.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode 117 of the Mad Happy Podcast. Hope you all are well. Today we are joined by Liz Tran, a really amazing conversation. I first became familiar with Liz. I didn't even know that it was her at the time, but with an Instagram page that she launched before COVID called Reset NYC, sort of went a little bit like viral in some of my circles. I definitely encourage you guys to check out the page. It's had really like thought-provoking and positive and sort of like mental health adjacent content that I think I personally really responded to, just in like contrast of a lot of other stuff that I was seeing at the time, and really took a lot of inspiration from the page with stuff we did with Local Optimist and even on the Mad Happy side. So that's really all I knew about Liz when we agreed to have her on the show. And then it turns out she's had this amazing career, is an amazing coach to so many founders, had a whole career in tech, ended up writing this book that she just came out with earlier this month called Karma of Success. And yeah, it was really, really great to learn more about her story, her background, sort of how she coaches these executives and uses a lot of her life experience and different practices in Buddhism, yoga, things like that, that she's become very well versed in, how to apply it in the business sense and in the sense of entrepreneurship and all these other things. So it was a really great episode. I think you guys are going to love it. And yeah, without further ado, the Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism. Enjoy the episode with Liz Tran. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm such a big fan of what you guys are doing.
Oh, no way. How did you first hear about us, curiously?
Years ago from my friend Diana Cohen.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And she was like, have you heard about this brand, Mad Happy? And I was like, no. And she's like, they're amazing. And that's all she said. And then I've just been sort of following your journey, bought some items, love the quality of what you produce as well. And it was just so different. I think a lot of people were kind of buzzing about it in New York when you guys first emerged.
Yeah. I saw it. I don't know if it's like a real friend or an Instagram friend for you, but Alex Brands was like a close friend who used to work for us a lot. I saw you guys had some interaction on there. So we got a mutual friend there.
He's a real friend. like a work friend.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. No, we love Alex. Well, yeah, we were super excited to have you on too. I think, you know, didn't honestly know like much about you or your story. Honestly, was just familiar with like the Instagram page, which I think is like so, has taken on a life of its own. Obviously, I'm sure like I'm excited to hear like more about it, but I think was always just really inspired by like the thoughtfulness and sort of like the provocation of that page. You know, I think there's a lot of sort of types of whatever, like wellness memes or like mental health content sort of like in that space. And I always really felt like your page was like so refreshing and had a bit more like sort of like stillness and like thoughtfulness to it, which I always really respected. And then to sort of, you know, see everything else that you do, and for that to just be like one piece of the pie, was really impressed and inspired. So the admiration is mutual, and yeah, super excited to chat with you.
Thank you. Yeah, the Instagram page was something that I did just for myself. It was like in the middle of the pandemic, and I was feeling, as we all were, so many feelings, yeah. And like so many stress and anxiety thoughts, and just, you know, there was so much transition and change, and I was reading a lot about psychology and mental health and just Buddhism and finding tools for myself to try to deal with so much uncertainty. And then I started drawing these diagrams, like just for myself, to basically say, okay, how do I make sense of these concepts? So, you know, like the Buddhist concept that life is 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows, like how do I express that? And I started drawing them out by hand. Then my friend Tessa would like put them on the computer, yeah. So they looked nice. And they were sort of just for us. And it was like this fun little project that we were doing together. And then pretty much overnight, we like gained 100,000 followers. And I think that's
so crazy.
Initial instinct of just like, we're doing this, of course, to help other people, but it's not really for like the likes or trying to follow the algorithm. Mm-hmm. It was so much more like, this is something that we both deeply need and find very healing. And so a lot of the posts are like aesthetic. It's kind of what we're feeling, thinking about. But the ones that are expressing a certain concept, it's from like an actual personal experience of trying to find a sense of meaning behind whatever it is we're going through.
Yeah. And I think that that comes through, you know, and I think all the best sort of brands or environments or sort of things that we try and create, like when they do have that personal element, I think that's really felt clearly. And obviously there's such a yearning for that type of content and like those types of thoughts and feelings and things to be expressed, you know, even similarly to us of just like, you know, the way that we sort of disrupted the apparel business is like, you know, there was such a yearning for a brand to talk about these sort of things, to champion these things, to sort of, you know, open up, to be about inclusivity, really express people to sort of be who they are and like not be shy to have those hard conversations or admit when you're suffering and things like that. And especially in the social media landscape, you know, it's like no surprise that like people were starving for that sort of content. Is it, has your mindset towards it sort of like shifted now that it's like so popular? Do you think about like, how can I monetize this page? How can I, you know, continue to keep up my content? Or is it still really sort of just like a passion project of like, you know, personal journey for you?
I think that that desire or like even that inclination exists in everyone, right? Like once they see something that's working, you're like, oh, do I need to keep this going? Yeah. And how I counteract that is I created like a set of three things I say to myself before I sit down to do any work, whether it's coaching, writing, working on social media or the podcast. And so it's just like my grounding work mantra. And so I say, may my learnings in hardships be of service to others. May I be growing in wisdom and abundance every day. And then may my belief and dedication to others inspire them to reach their greatest potential. And so just by having like a counteracting force to like make money, get likes, you know, like just being able to fill that space with a, with something else, I think is important.
Yeah. It's like your own little serenity prayer, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I know you just released a book, right? Like today, literally, or like yesterday?
I released it on Tuesday.
Amazing.
And it was really fun. Thank you. And this week has been just lots of fun events and media and things like that. And yeah, it's just gone really well.
Nice. Is it like the first time you've ever published a book before?
It is. Wow. It's my first book. Yeah.
How many years in the making was it?
I have wanted to write a book for my whole life, but really actively wanting to write a book, I don't know, maybe for 10 years. I mean, I guess probably not actively, but I had this idea, okay, maybe I'll write a book. But honestly, it all kind of was a silver lining of the pandemic. So I used to have this space in Manhattan. It was like, it was a studio that I called a studio for learning, and companies would bring their employees there for corporate retreats. And then we would also at night on the weekends have these classes for like kind of integrated learning of the self. So it might be a class on astrology or a sound bath or a meditation. And I put all of my savings and basically like literally everything I had made working in venture capital into remodeling the space and making it beautiful. And it, you know, lost money for a bunch of months. And then finally it started to make money. And I was like, yes, it's working. The classes are filling up. People know about it. We got all this great press. And then it was March 17th, 2020, and in-person gatherings were totally shut down, which was my only revenue stream. And so shut down the studio, and it was only open for 9 months, moved everything to storage. And I suddenly had all this time where I had to figure out, how do I pivot this business? How do I take this brand that I've built and like turn it into something? And so I started experimenting with different forms, but because for the first time in my life, I had time, I decided maybe I should learn how to write. Maybe I should actually work on this book. And so that was the beginning of it. And so essentially I took classes on writing. I read a lot of writing books. I worked on a proposal for like a year, and then I sold it in 2021. And then it takes 2 years for a book to come out. Like people don't really know. Yeah. It's so long. They give you a year to write it because you like pre-sell it before you write it. And then it takes a year to do all the stuff of like making the cover and, you know, blah, 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 all the publishing stuff.
Yeah. But like, what were your sort of thoughts or inspirations when you really realized like, I'm going to like, it's COVID. I want to write this book. Sort of how are you able to start to think about like the biggest sort of themes that you wanted to touch on, or who do I want this to be for? Or like sort of all those existential things, because, you know, you have such a
such a wealth of like experience and knowledge in that way that I feel like it's like, where do you even start?
Yeah. I mean, the premise of the book is that one, it's a business book in a way. I mean, it's published by Penguin Random House, and the imprint that it's published by is like, they publish business books by like CEOs, and you know, mm-hmm. that's what they do. And so at its core, it's about your career, but it's also a deeply spiritual book. So it's sort of the hybrid between the two. And the business part comes from my experience coaching founders. So I've been coaching founders for 4 years now of like seed through Series C companies, mm-hmm. mostly in tech. But my ability to do that and to build this business and build my practice all came from non-business related sources of wisdom, like Buddhism, the Tao,
yeah.
even astrology, Reiki. And so I pull a lot of those learnings into the book as well. And what I wanted to tell people is that they don't have to follow a prescribed path. Like, I think a lot of times we think success has all these external qualities to it. It's like the awards you win, how much you get paid, mm-hmm. you know, what your title is. And I wanted to show people that those things, while they're great, they're very fleeting and they never make us happy. You know, how many people know that cliche of the person who has it all, mm-hmm. and they're the most deeply unhappy, dissatisfied person. But I don't think we have another path, like a separate alternative option for what might really bring lasting happiness and feel meaningful. And so I want to draw on ancient sources of wisdom, as well as like my work as a coach, to answer that question of, okay, if like all these external things, these superficial things we know aren't making us happy, what do we do now?
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. I think I've definitely experienced a lot of that, even just since we've started Mad Happy. Like, you know, I've had my own sort of like mental health issues and struggles, have like dealt with imposter syndrome a lot. And it's really just like, you know, I dropped out of college. So there was always this idea in my head of like, oh, I don't have a degree, sort of, I haven't checked that box. Like, I'll never be able to be taken seriously. And a lot of those things. And really I owe a lot of like my progress and like my recovery through like sobriety and like 12 step programs, I think have been huge, just for like, for the relationship with self. When you talk about like, where else is it going to come from? You know, I think there's really only one place that it can come from, and that's really from ourselves. And I think it's like, even if we have amazing partners or children or family or best friends, right, there's still nothing like being able to produce it for yourself, right? Like, no one can do that for you. And I think that's been like my biggest learning of like, you know, I feel like it's such an underrated thing in society to even really get to know yourself or like spend time with yourself and like ask yourself these questions. We're so sort of like career and you know, traditional success oriented that it's like, you know, go to college, get the job, keep going, work hard, get the promotion. And it's like, you know, we really don't stop and take that time to really get to know ourselves and ask ourselves those questions and spend time alone, especially with the internet and social media now. It's like, you're really sort of never alone in that way. But yeah, I feel like that relationship with self is like such an underrated part of the process of at least sort of finding alternate routes for that happiness for me.
Yeah, that's so beautifully said. And I also think, in addition to getting to know ourselves, it's about giving ourselves what we need. You know, I think sometimes we're looking for those sources of validation from other people. Mm. So we pour all this energy into doing these external things, hoping that someone will look at us and be like, you're okay. You know, and then my big learning was like, it's so much more efficient and so much more direct just to do that for yourself, you know, to be like, hey, you're okay. What do you need? How can I help you? How can I love you more?
Yeah.
Versus like, let me do all these things so that people might love me or respect me or think I'm smart. It's like, you can just do that for yourself, which I think is a really beautiful and also very effective and fast learning.
Totally. So I know you said you've been coaching for 4 years now, I guess. What was the, and you used to work in tech, is that right?
Yeah, I worked at a venture capital firm called Thrive Capital in New York. I worked there for like almost 4 years. And then before that, I was working in tech. So I've been working with and around founders for a while.
Yeah, nice. I mean, I guess my biggest question, the thing that I was most interested about, was like, what was it that sort of happened that led for you to sort of make this pivot in life?
Yeah, so I guess maybe I'll just like start at the beginning, but I'll go really quickly.
That's fine, yeah.
Because I think it's a like helpful frame for my psyche and decision making. I grew up like in a very, very typical kind of like immigrant circumstance. My mom came to the U.S. from Vietnam. She was an immigrant. She was a single mom. We grew up in like government subsidized housing. We had no money. And it was very chaotic. Like life was just so, so up and down. You know, yeah. I think I moved, I went to like 5 elementary schools, oh 2 middle God. Schools and 2 high schools.
Was it just you and her, or do you have siblings or other family in the picture?
I had one brother who's very close in age to me. So it was the 3 of us.
Nice.
And he and I are really close. And there was some family around, which was nice. I had cousins in the area. Yeah. And my, I think the association I drew was a lack of money equals chaos and unhappiness. And so I was like, oh, I know how to fix this. I'll just go make a lot of money. Like everything will be okay. Done. So I kind of started on this trajectory where, you know, I got into tech, not because I really wanted to work in tech, but I was like, seems the right thing to do. Yeah. And then, you know, I got this job in venture capital where I was an executive, and suddenly it was like I had arrived. You know, I worked at one of the best firms in the world. Mm. I was the only female executive. I was making tons of money, like more than I ever knew was possible. And I was also really unhappy.
Mm.
And on the surface, it seemed like I had achieved everything I always wanted, but it wasn't really like the life. It was a perfect life, but it wasn't really the life that I wanted. It was like a life I had constructed around some fictional idea of yeah. like what I thought I should yeah. want.
Is there like, I'm curious, like to know how you even knew that you were unhappy, because I feel like a lot of people are in that position, but it's sort of like hard to really stop and see, or even sort of know what it is, I guess. Was there like a specific moment, or was it just like a few months of feeling something, or how were you able to identify that unhappiness, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. Like I actually didn't know I was unhappy about work, and I started going to therapy because of a breakup.
Yeah.
And I was 31 at the time. And I was like, originally I thought I was going because I wanted to like heal from these 2 back-to-back breakups, figure out why my relationships weren't working. And then it became like, once I started unpacking and like opened the box, it was like, whoa, everything is off.
Yeah.
And so it happened kind of slowly, but like from going to therapy. And then once I started going to therapy, you know, my therapist said, why don't you just start exploring the things that you like? Like, don't worry about solving all your issues right now. Mm-hmm. And so I was really drawn to Buddhism, and I started going to these Buddhist sanghas, like where, you know, they sit and talk to you about a topic, and Buddhist meditation retreats. I'd go all the time. And then I started reading about more about like the philosophy behind Buddhism and how to live life. And I was like, oh, there's something really interesting here. And I had been partying, going out a lot at the yeah. time. And I just stopped drinking completely. And wow. I stopped going out. And that, and it, so I didn't know that you were in 12 step, but like I was not, but it was like, it kind of freed up this space that had been
yeah.
taking up my life before yeah. where I suddenly had time to like sit and be quiet. Yeah. And something I talk about in the book is that we all need the 3 S's, which is stillness, solitude, and silence, but it's so hard to find it. And I had this vacuum, like once I stopped going out and partying, I didn't really have a lot of friends anymore because they were like all friends that I did that thing with. And so I was alone and I had quiet and I could think, and I was like, oh, once I slowed down, I could start to see it. And it took a while. You know, I think it was like a couple years to finally come to the realization that I needed to leave my job. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of went on this trajectory of like realizing I was unhappy, then trying to figure out what might make me happy, and then getting the courage to believe in myself enough to be able to do that. And then when that happened was when I quit my job and I started Reset. You know, and I think the journey is like obviously going on all the time, totally. But I feel so lucky that I recovered like a sense of agency
yeah.
that I had control over my life.
Was that your first experience with therapy when you had first gone in after those breakups?
I had gone to therapy in college for like a year. And I thought it was great and super helpful. And so I had this mindset of, oh, I've been to therapy, I'm fine. And I had a partner once who was like, I think you should go to therapy. Like you kind of drink a lot and like you black out all the time. And I was like, one, first of all, blacking out is fine. Yeah, it's normal, yeah. which is a crazy thought to have. And then secondly, I was like, I've been to therapy, I'm healed. And so I had the wrong assumption around it. So it was kind of like when I started going, it was almost like going again for the first time.
Yeah. No, that's amazing. I love those 3 S's. You know, even I'm talking to one of my friends right now who's, you know, sort of feeling a little bit depressed, is like looking to maybe, should I get sober? Sort of like, how do I deal with this? Like a little bit in a funk. And I think one of the biggest things is like really to you know, sort of give yourself like a baseline to really be able to identify how you feel and what's going on. And like to achieve that baseline, I feel like it totally is those three S's that you said of like, I sort of need just like the solitude away from all that partying and whatever, and like social things and all those other circumstances, really like the stillness and silence. Was that the last one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stillness, silence, and solitude.
Yeah. And like, you know, to really sort of flush everything away and sit and see like what's going on. And then it's like the biggest thing that I love to do that I talk about with people all the time is like those top line behaviors, as like, you know, I think that our bottom lines in addiction get much more of the conversation and attention. But I think really those top line things are like more valuable. And those are the things that really keep us sort of growing and learning. Like you said, when your therapist had recommended to just go spend time like learning about the things that you like, right? It's like, what are those top line behaviors that you can redirect your time and energy to into there? And then it's just like, we don't know what's going to happen, but just like see the ripple effect like from that, right? Like when you break it down like that, it can be so simple of just like, what are these things that are making you sad? All right, stop doing those and go do some of these things that sort of make you happy. And it's like, just do that for 30 days in a row and then like see what happens. And then, you know, through that, like you were able to spawn a whole like universe that you've created, which is awesome.
That is so true. It's like, it seems so simple, that challenge of like, just take really good care of yourself for 30 days, but it's so hard to do, you know, it is so, so revolutionary.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that. I mean, I think we're really hard on ourselves.
Totally.
You know, we hold ourselves to these standards and put this like expectation around what we think we deserve and like how hard we should push ourselves that we would never do to someone else. Mm-hmm. And I see this with my clients all the time because they're founders of companies. They are so hard on themselves with every, you know, misstep of the business. They blame themselves, right? And their self-esteem takes a hit. It's like this yo-yo, right? Like mm-hmm. The business is doing well. They feel good. Business isn't doing well. They feel horrible about themselves and up and down. It's totally tethered to something outside of themselves. And what I always say to them is I'm like, you are your own boss. So imagine if your boss said all these things to you, these negative, critical things, you would quit your job, right? Like if someone just berated you constantly for how badly you were doing.
Yeah.
And so you are now your own boss for the first time. You don't have someone else giving you that reinforcement. So that dialogue is so important.
Yeah. We used to have a saying here, that my mom told me that was treat yourself like someone you love. And I think that's sort of exactly what you're saying in that way of like, we often are our toughest critic, obviously, but you're like, you would never talk to one of your reports like that, or you would never talk to your manager like that, or even one of your friends or your partner at home, you know, but for some reason we have that dialogue with ourselves that just only sort of like drags us down further and further.
Your mom sounds very wise.
Yeah. I mean, you know, she had me in therapy since I was 7 years old based on other sort of, you know, family trauma and circumstance. But yeah, she's really special. I guess once you were able to sort of quit your job, I think you said like 2 years after you had started therapy again, I guess, what was that moment like? And like, how did you feel confident and comfortable to be able to make such a big change like that? You know, I feel like change is like a great topic that I want to speak on of just, you know, it's people can consciously know that maybe they're not happy in this marriage or this job or this friendship or whatever it is, but really like to make that change oftentimes feels so insurmountable and so paralyzing that the easiest thing to do becomes just sort of nothing. And that's how we get so stuck. Like, how were you able to sort of really, really do that?
I think there's two answers. The first answer is like, what did I think in the moment? And then the second answer is like, now that I'm looking back, what was actually happening? You know, because I think we don't always have full awareness.
A little revisionist history. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Or like, you know, bringing more accuracy to like the very subjective perspective that I had at the time.
Yeah.
And at the time, I think part of it was like, I just like found myself getting really annoyed and really angry at like everything that was happening at my job. I was just so aggravated. But I think that was my subconscious's way of like trying to help me leave the job, because now I look back in hindsight and like the things that happened weren't even like bad. You know, I just found a reason to be mad. Like I was looking for a reason to be able to quit.
Yeah.
Because it was easier to like blame someone else and be like, I can't stay here anymore, than for me to say, yeah, I'm taking a risk on myself. But now that I look back and I think about what happened, I've been thinking a lot about that question you asked of how does change happen? You know, it's so hard. How does it actually culminate in like someone doing something different? And I'm actually writing my next book about this. It's like all about this idea that we all have AQ, which is like your agility quotient, which is more important than how smart you are. It's like, how good are you at change, uncertainty, and the unknown? Mm-hmm. But my theory is that you need four things to have change actually implement. The first, and it's an acronym that spells out ACEs, and the A stands for anchors. Like you actually need enough stability in your life to allow yourself to change. Whether it's a partner, it's your family of origin, it's like some community or religion mm-hmm. or something that you're a part of, you do need to feel safe in order to take a risk. And I think I had found that with my partner, and I had found that with friendships and Buddhism. And so finally I had that check mark fulfilled, because like when your whole life feels really messy and disorganized, it's hard to even say like, yeah, I'm going to make a big change here. So I think looking for something you can just ground onto.
Yeah.
The C stands for conviction. And I think that's just having confidence in yourself. So building up enough to say, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I think I'm going to be okay. Like, you know, I'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was part of it. Like I kind of looked back and I thought, I've done this before. I've done the unknown. I've jumped into something I didn't know how to do. This shouldn't be any different. Plus I had known a bunch of founders. And so that kind of normalized it for me. I was like, okay, I know a lot of people have taken risks.
Yeah.
The E stands for environment. So that's like literally just putting yourself in a situation where you are more apt to make changes. And I think that's what I was subconsciously doing, is I was like saying, I can't stay here anymore. I can't be in venture capital. And then finally the last word, S, is for symbiosis. And so it's this idea that, you know, you're looking for synchronicity in your life, and you're like believing that like whatever is happening to you is like meant to be, there's some divine hand. You know, I think that there's always this element of like, we have to kind of believe that the universe has our back and wants us to do something. Mm. And so I think all those four ingredients kind of fell into place at the right time.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes, I have my anchor. I have conviction in myself. I'm like putting myself in the environment to change. And then finally, like, I'm kind of like choosing to believe that this is all meant to be.
Yeah. I love that. Which letter would you say you struggle with the most?
I think I struggle with the S the most, because when things happen to me,
yeah,
I'm always like, why? Why? When really I should be like, okay, maybe this is happening for me. Maybe this is like all part of a divine plan.
Yeah. I think.
What about you?
I think the C for me, and I think like the C from a lot of people that I talk to also, because I think there's this idea around the change where you have to have like 100% conviction or like 100% confidence in that way. And I think what I learned for myself is like any big change, like where you know, would sort of look at the ACEs in that way, like, I don't think that you'll ever feel 100%. And I think that's like part of it. And I think that's okay. And I think that a lot of people, myself included, have like been waiting for that complete conviction to make a change. And oftentimes it becomes too late, or, you know, the situation gets a little bit worse and you should have made it earlier. And like, for me, it's like, there always has been some like leap of faith and like some risk involved that I have to be consciously aware of like, I, maybe if I get to like 80% on this one, but I like, you know, but the A, E, and the S are like, I feel it, you know, then like I still sort of have to go for it and not just sort of wait around. Because I think with most things, like there's always like the brain is too smart and powerful to be 100%. There'll always be those other thoughts of that 1% that sort of creep in that I think can really like paralyze a lot of people.
I think that's a really good point. And I think maybe relying on like the E of the environment, it's almost like, you know, you're scared, but you have someone just like push you into the water anyway, mm-hmm. where it's like, maybe you're scared, but you're like, okay, I'm going to force myself to like, you know, I'm just doing this as a hypothetical.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe you're thinking about starting Mad Happy and you're scared and you're like, I don't know if I can do this, but you're like, I'm going to force myself to like do these brainstorming sessions with this co-founder.
Yeah.
Because like that will force me into it. And, you know, I think that's true. It's like we can never feel 100% certainty. And if we wait till that point, it's already too late.
Yeah.
Right? Like yeah. There's something really nice about like just jumping. And I think of, this is another acronym, but I'm really into acronyms, but FEAR, mm-hmm. And what FEAR actually means. And someone told this to me once, it's the false evaluation about risk. And so we're afraid when we are overstating the amount of risk that there could be. We're like, oh, wow, this is scary. It could all unfold. But that's just fear, mm-hmm. right? Like when you have like a very accurate understanding of like what could happen, then, it, you know, you're not as afraid anymore. You're like, okay, so what?
Yeah.
What if we fail? Yeah. Who cares?
Way less anxiety. I love the A too. I think that's such an important one to really start with. I think, you know, that foundation or that home base of safety, whatever it looks like for you, whether it's like a place or a person or whatever, you know, I think that's absolutely vital, because without that, you're just like, you're so naked that you can't even begin to, you know, C, E, or S, because you don't have that. You know, like I had a friend who just like broke up with his girlfriend and they live together, and they're like, you know, he's going on a trip, so they're gonna like stay in the place for like a week until he left or something like that. And I'm like, how's it going? He's like, it's going terribly, because like he doesn't feel safe like in his own home, right? And it's like that sort of that's step one. So I think it's a good call putting that first.
What are your anchors?
Yeah, I mean, I think like home base and like foundation, like I would say is like number one. You know, I found that like as I've gotten older, I continue to gravitate more towards people and places that I knew since my childhood. You know, I think those mm-hmm. are really the ones that I feel the best around, like my friends from summer camp, right? Or like people who really knew me. I feel like before anyone had jobs, before anyone went to college, like before, like really we were just like young souls, like figuring it out and sort of growing up, and like people who really I feel like don't judge me and just like love me and support me unconditionally. I think like surrounding myself with as many of those people at all times as possible. Then it comes like some of those top line behaviors for me are like, you know, I literally have a list of 10 and I try and just like, if I do one, at least one a day, you know, like I have to be kind to myself, like we were saying, and be grateful that like that's an amazing day. So even if it's like a really busy day at the office, if I can get outside and spend 10 minutes in the sun, if I can get a workout in, if I can play tennis or basketball or pickleball, if I can watch a movie, if I can like eat a home cooked meal, right? I think it's like really those things, I think, that really fuel my soul, that I literally have like a group chat of like of some guys where like every single day we send each other which one of our top line behaviors we did. And I think there's like, you know, it can be the shittiest day at work, or we released a collection and it flopped, or my girlfriend's mad at me, or whatever, but like really trying to have that grace that like, you know, if I can just do one of those things and like, you know, stay off my bottom lines as well, of course, you know, like that's a successful day. And I think it's just about like taking those one at a time and like stringing together as many as possible. It's like, and which one am I going to get tomorrow? And then just, you know, you look up and we've been running this business for 7 years, and I've had a girlfriend for 5 years, and I've been sober for over 5 years. And it's sort of just like all these things coming together, based off just like a bunch of little baby steps and like micro goals, you know?
Yeah. I think it's beautiful that you have a list of 10 and that you're just like, I just have to do one today at a minimum. Yeah. And then I feel really good and I love myself. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. If you get two, great. Three, yeah. Incredible. I'm curious, like when you left to start like your coaching practice, obviously you're sort of pulling in all these, you know, maybe atypical principles and sort of like modalities for the corporate world. Like, was it difficult at first to sort of work with people and like introduce like some of these new sort of thoughts and ideas? Or like, how did you sort of think about molding this when you began to like pitch yourself and like make a business out of this and like really string it all together in that way?
Yeah. I mean, 100%, especially because I hadn't really thought that, you know, you could be your authentic self, like whatever that means to people. But like, you know, when I was working venture capital, I didn't really talk about a lot of the things that I liked, mm-hmm. you know, I would talk about art or culture or, you know, the things that you know, were resonant with everyone mm-hmm. who worked at the firm with me. But I wouldn't be like, oh, I'm going to go like buy crystals yeah. or like, you know, you go to a sound to Reiki class? Yeah, exactly. You know, like, what did you do this weekend? I would just give some vague answer. I wouldn't like actually tell them what I really did.
Yeah.
And you know, and I actually think looking back, like I probably would have been accepted if I had
yeah.
just said who I was. It was all in my, it's all in my head.
Totally.
And, you know, that's been a big, this is like, I think we all have kind of these lifelong stories that we tell ourselves or these struggles that we have. And this is one of mine, is like, can I really be my true self? and be accepted for it. And, you know, it's something my friend Sandy says, where, you know, we all have something like that, some wound. And it's like a record, like the record always has the same grooves in it, always plays the same song, but you can learn how to turn the volume really way down on the record. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be blasting in your ear. And so I think over time, like it's something I'm always working on, and I'm always trying to turn down the music on like this idea. And so even when it came to writing this book, it originally was just a business book. It was just a book that was trying to convey the ideas of coaching to more people and make it more accessible, because, you know, coaching is kind of expensive. Not a lot of people can afford it. Mm-hmm. And it's really reserved for like leadership team and founders, but I wanted to give it to everyone. Yeah. And my agent was like, Liz, this is kind of boring. Like, it's a good book, like idea, but it's bland. Like, who are you? Tell me about the things you really care about.
Yeah.
And I was like, huh, interesting. And I was like, well, I'm really into spirituality, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, okay, cool. Write that. Write a hybrid, business and spirituality. Wow. And I was like, well, will it sell? Because someone told me that I have to choose a lane, and that like, if I write a spirituality book, it should be a spirituality book. If I write a business book, it should be a business book. Otherwise booksellers won't know what to do with it.
Lost. Yeah.
Yeah. And she was like, no, like you write who you are and that will be a successful book. And my agent is like, she's a Vietnamese woman who's probably around like close to my mom's age.
Wow.
And to like, it was this like beautiful, like maternal healing line for her to be like, yeah, just be who you are. You're great.
Yeah.
And so I honestly say the way I answer that question is like, it's actually taken me like up until recently to fully integrate all of this into my coaching. I had two separate worlds where it was like, I'm a business coach and I'm coaching these founders. And then I also have, you know, this podcast and this Instagram on the side where I'm talking about other things. And I never let the two of those cross. Wow. And then in the act of writing this book, it's been very freeing. And like, you know, this venture firm that I partner with, who I have a lot of clients who came through this venture firm. They threw me like a big party for my book, you know, so all my clients have been really supportive of it.
Yeah.
But I did have this belief. I was like, I didn't even tell a lot of them about the book because I thought, you know, I don't want them to think that I'm not prioritizing them and my work as a coach. Mm. And so it was this mental block that I had to get through where I was like, no, your clients know you. And like, this is a part of you. Like, let them know you.
Yeah. Wow. That's so interesting that you really hadn't like bridged that gap until recently. So did you sort of rethink your whole curriculum and like approach with the coaching now with this like injected spirituality? How did you go about that?
It's interesting because as a coach, it hasn't changed. And I think because, you know, the way I coach, the spiritual aspect of it is so much more about grounding myself. So I show up in the right way as a coach versus like forcing something on my clients that they maybe don't want and maybe don't need. And so if a client asks and is curious about something, then I'll share more with them.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's really more about me being able to release the ego in the work that I do. Because as a coach, a lot of people think, oh, you must have all the right answers. You must know, you know, business so well and tell them what to do. But the good coaches tell their clients what to do. The truly great coaches don't really do that. Mm. You know, they actually help their clients become better so that they know the answer to themselves.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of my work isn't to be like, hey, you should read this book about Buddhism because it's the right path for you, or read this book about stoicism. Right.
Like, let's meditate so for 10 minutes to start our session or whatever.
Yeah. And some people want that, but most people don't. And I'm there, honestly, my job is to help them solve business problems. Like that's actually like, if the company is succeeding, then that's my job.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do that partly through helping this individual reach their greatest potential, whatever that looks like.
Yeah.
And so for me, I'm like, a lot of it is relinquishing an idea of like what tools I think they need, but rather just listening and helping them like go on their own path and their own unique journey.
Yeah. Do you feel like the answer to solving those business problems a lot of the time, like does come back to like these executives and like their personal sort of like thoughts, opinions, beliefs about like themselves and the world? Or does it really stay in like business? Like, all right, let's really look at like the team and assess like the situation of like how we can actually fix this more from like a practical sense on that side.
Yeah, that's such a great question. I think it's equally 50-50.
Yeah.
Like, of course, like you, let me actually only think of like a, an example. So let's say I have a client who is in the middle of a fundraise, mm-hmm. right? Or like they're kicking off a fundraise. And obviously this is like not the best environment to raise capital. Things were really easy in like 2021, yeah. like, you know, less so in 2022 even, but like, you know, not right now. And so we want to do all the pieces of like, okay, what's your strategy? Which firms are you reaching out to? Is your data room pulled together? What are you saying in your pitch? That is so important to get that dialed in. I call that the steak. You know, it's like literally the meat of what it is you're doing. Mm-hmm. But you also need the sizzle. And the sizzle is like, if that founder shows up to fundraise and they are not aligned and they're not feeling confident and they're not feeling grounded, no matter how good the steak is, there's no sizzle. Mm-hmm. But you can't, you know, I think you need both. They're both so important. It's like the mindset of the founder coupled with like deep preparation. And I think it's kind of the same as like, if you've ever done like, you know, a marathon or some sort of endurance
yeah.
racing or a long camping trip, you definitely need to have like the muscle matter for mm-hmm. it, but it's so much about mindset also.
Totally. I have a couple questions for you just about sort of themes that you've experienced with like your different coaching selfishly, so I can steal some for me and my partners. But what are like the most common sort of like struggles or bottlenecks that you see with different like executive teams or leaders or businesses, if there had to be sort of like a through line that most CEOs and people sort of struggle with in that way?
Yeah. Okay. So it's a great question. The first one is not doing the right things. Like by that, I mean like not spending your day in the right way, not putting your energy towards
time management and stuff like that.
Yeah, time management, but also like focus. And so I think all of us have what's called a zone of genius. And that is when we do work and we're really good at it. And it also gives us energy. Like you feel like you can get into the flow state. You feel good about it. And then next to that is this type of work called your zone of excellence. And it's like the stuff that you do pretty well that people are like, hey, Mason, can you keep doing this? Can you take this on this project for me? But you feel so depleted at the end of doing it, like it's like not what you love doing and it like you feel it. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of it is like, and then there's obviously these two other zones of like zone of incompetence and zone of competence where it's like stuff that you're not very good at.
Yeah.
Most of us don't really do that stuff. And so it's really just like differentiating between the two. And I have a lot of founders who get stuck in the zone of excellence where they're doing all the stuff because the company needs them to, because they're great at it. But they feel so exhausted at the end of the day. And they hate their work. You know, it's like, it might be like doing business development or it might be like doing the finances or something. It's like something that people are like, oh, this is obviously what you need to do. And so what I work on with my clients is I'm like, let's try to get your zone of genius to be over 50% of your day to day. That way you're ending every day like net positive, because the fastest way to get to burnout is that you just like are doing all these things that you think the company needs, but are destroying you. You know, and I think founders will sacrifice a lot of themselves for what they believe to be the good of the company. And so I think reframing that for them where I'm like, no, the best thing you can do for your company is to be in your zone of genius as close to 90% of the time as possible.
Yeah.
Does that resonate with you?
Totally. I mean, can definitely relate to that. I feel like, especially in a startup, obviously that there's just so much going on every single day and you just want to stay as productive as possible, as busy as possible, accomplish as many things as you can at like in a day. And like, it really is, even a lot of conversations that we're having like right now are really about that, like focus, you know, and let's sort of like click out and like really take inventory of like, you know, I'd really rather do 3-4 things at 80% than do these dozen things at maybe 50%, but it just feels like you're doing more things. So it feels like you're doing more productive, but at a lower level, like outside of that zone that you talk about. And obviously it's just not sustainable and like ultimately ends up being worse for the business, even if you might technically be getting more done.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I would bucket that into the realm of like personal effectiveness. Like I'm just trying to get my clients to be as good at what they're doing as possible in mm-hmm. a way that is sustainable. And so it even comes down to like just looking at their calendars sometimes. Like I literally had a session earlier today where he didn't want to do it, but I was like, open your calendar for next week. I was like, literally take me through one by one. He had like 25 meetings that we wanted, needed to talk about.
Right.
And then we wound up getting rid of seven of them,
yeah.
You know, and like that
that's huge.
Might seem really tactical to someone, but I'm like, I'm here for it. Like right. I'm here to like
have
these conversations yeah. with you. You can't talk to anyone else about that. Like, yeah. it's like, who are you going to call over and be like, look at my calendar with me.
Yeah.
And the second thing I would say is like, I coach a lot on interpersonal communication.
Mm.
How do you coach your team?
Yeah.
How do you give them feedback? How do you fire someone? How do you convince someone to join your company? And I think that people don't always realize that there's like a kind of like a skill and a strategy around communication interpersonally to be able to like try to get someone to see, you know, to be happy with what you're telling them, you know, like, and so it's sort of like I help my clients get into the shoes of the people that they're trying to talk to. You know, and oftentimes it's like, how do I give feedback to this person? And they give the feedback and it doesn't work. So we figure that out. And then finally, the third bucket is around the idea of like who they are becoming, you know? And I think that the company can only grow as fast as the founders can scale.
Yeah.
You know, the rate limiting factor is like the personal development.
Yeah.
And so I help kind of codify learnings, you know, like what did we learn this past year? What did we learn this month? What do you want to get rid of? Let's postmortem this. What do you want to stop doing? What do you want to keep doing? Yeah. What skills do you need to evolve, et cetera?
Totally. My second one, and maybe you won't have anything because this is when I assume there was maybe a bit more spirituality in your coaching, but what ideas or thoughts like do you find people push back on the most or sort of have the hardest time like integrating or really like accepting?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great question. The first thing that I think people have trouble pushing back on is, or like trouble accepting when it comes to being a founder is that like, and this actually is maybe a little bit spiritual,
yeah.
but like accepting that like sometimes the things just aren't meant to be. You know, and I think that founders often get into it and they're like, I need to control everything. It's all like about me. It's all under my control. And you know, what I always say is I'm like, okay, one, these bad things might be happening to you, but it's because there's a lesson there that you need to learn.
Right.
And Pema Chodron, not
to you. Yeah,
exactly. And, Pema Chodron, a Buddhist nun, she says nothing goes away until it teaches you what you need to know. Which I think is so beautiful. And so my clients are often like, no, but I need to fix it. You know, I coach a lot of people who come up through the technical realm, like computer science or, you know, biology or whatever. And they're like, no, but like, what's the answer? Where's the data? And I'm like, no. There's like an intuitive learning or lesson here. And so I think that's something that is more of a spiritual aspect that people don't want to actually acknowledge where I'm like, okay, but why is this a good thing? What can we do with this? How do you turn this obstacle into your advantage? Versus wanting to like control everything finitely in the first place.
Yeah, that's like, that's such an interesting piece too, especially just when it comes to like, you know, personnel and culture and building your team. It's like, there are all these sort of intangibles that like, there's no answer. Like, you know, there's no like one solve. And I think for like business oriented people, especially from the computer science and biology world, right? It's like, that's can be such a hard theme to really grapple of like, it doesn't matter how hard you work or like what you put in, you know, it's more of just like a feeling people like social and emotional based sort of business most of the time.
Yeah, totally. And I think something that is probably a huge advantage for you is that like, you know, the importance of taking care of yourself and mental health. And I think that's another thing is that I think clients sometimes push back and they're like, well, time spent on my mental health and well-being, like, I should just be doing emails during that time. And like, it is one of the biggest lessons that they often learn in the beginning with me where I'm like, no, you have to make sure that like your foundation is right. Like take care of the engine and then the journey will take care of itself.
Yeah. But, like you'll go further.
You'll go further, but you'd be surprised how much people push back on that where, you know, I have clients who don't eat all day until it's 4 PM or, you know, I talk to them and it's like 2 PM and they're like, is it okay if I use the bathroom? I haven't gone to the bathroom all day. I'm like, why are you not going to the bathroom? You
know? Right. Like that, like the fundamental, like self-care pieces of just like survival almost like sort of get taken for granted and go out the window.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you risk everything to start this business only to take away your basic human dignity, you know, it doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And so that's kind of what I say is like, it's not being selfish. You're taking care of yourself and the business follows.
Yeah. Lastly, I was curious, just like few words that come to mind for you when I say like best best traits to have as a leader or like an executive?
That's such a good question. Okay. Best traits to have as a leader, executive. I think the first one is this like discomfort or like with comfort with the unknown and uncertainty. Like, I think getting that is so important because like you said, things will always like fly off the rails. Like that's just like the only part of constant it, in running a business and building a startup is that there is no constants. Like as soon as something settles into how you think it's always going to be, it gets disrupted so quickly right afterwards. And so I think getting really like used to that type of rhythm is super important. There's a personality test that I use on my clients and they call it prudence. It's like a weird word, but they call it like being a low prudence person, which means you're fine in ambiguity. You're comfortable with change. You know, you can figure things out from first principles. And the opposite of that is like high prudence, which I think is really bad. Just being like too rooted in like, oh, this is the process. So we have to follow it. Or this is the way we said it was going to be. So I think that fluidity and that agility is really important. And then the second thing I'll say is like, you know, it's the balance of, it's this very, very difficult balance between being so optimistic, like you are the biggest cheerleader and biggest believer in your business, while also holding, being like trying to pre-predict all the things that can go wrong. It's like pessimism like in spades and optimism in spades and like nothing in between, but just like holding both simultaneously.
I love that. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for the time and for all your wisdom. Congratulations again on the book. I can't wait to check it out. And yeah, really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for coming on, Liz.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's fun like to be able to talk about these with a founder, like someone who's actually living it. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Thank you guys so much for listening. As always, it means the world to us that you take time out of your busy lives to participate in these conversations. You know, we spend a lot of time preparing them for you and organizing them for you on our side. So it's always great when people choose to tune in. As always, please remember to give us a 5-star review and follow the show wherever you listen. And we'll be back next week. Have a great weekend, everybody. Peace. The Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism.